it appears that COVID-19 symptoms like cough, fever, sore throat, and loss of taste and smell are beginning to present themselves, you can begin to self-isolate and take a rapid test at home. After getting your test results, you can learn more about proper self-isolation guidelines by visiting quebec.ca/self-isolating. This information is there to help protect you and everyone living under the same roof. All of us can make a difference, so let's keep making sure all of us are safe. A message from the gouvernement du Québec.
You're listening to CKUT 90.3 FM for February 16th, 2022. It's about 6 p.m., just a bit after, and this is In the Motherhood. I'm your host, Robin Fadden. On today's show, we're featuring a podcast episode from Montreal podcast The Effect on Us, which is hosted by Eliane Goldstein. She's a high school student here in Montreal. And the podcast is for people of all ages, she said, to learn about controversial topics and the ties they have to people today and life today, really. Social, political, all kinds of issues tie into the stories that are told on her podcast. And in this first season of the podcast, The Effect on Us, Eliane's focus is on the Holocaust. and that runs from before the beginning of World War II to throughout the war and the years following, and the stories that people tell about their lives and how the Holocaust affected them, especially as children, and how it affected their families as well. She speaks to people whose childhoods were uprooted and often who were separated from their families. I wanted to draw attention to this podcast because Eliane is helping to share an important part of history that still has repercussions today, not only on the families of Holocaust survivors, but to the broader social and political state of the world. The Effect on Us podcast is hosted by Buzzsprout. You can find it there and listen to it there. It's also on all podcasting apps. You can find The Effect on Us on Facebook, and I'll link to that on the In the Motherhood CKUT Facebook page as well. With permission from the podcast, I'm going to broadcast Eliane's recent interview with Eva Perlman, who tells her story of leaving Germany for France during the war and how a series of miracles, as she calls it, saved her. And she was separated from her parents, who went into hiding, and had to place their three children in a safe home in France before the whole family went into hiding together later in a village in the countryside. And there were many Jewish people who were also hiding as well, and they were under constant threat by German raids throughout the war, and they had to change their identities, and basically their lives were kind of in a constant state of upheaval. So she speaks of her childhood experiences and what her parents had to do to keep them all alive, and that happened both through planning and through happenstance. I'll play that interview right now. Thank you for listening to CKUT 90.3 FM.
Hi, my name is Eliane Goldstein, and you're listening to The Effect on Us.
It wasn't a question of light living. It was a question of saving your life, because we fled for our lives from Czechoslovakia, where the Jews were persecuted by the occupying Germans.
And when we came home, we found out the Germans grounded our Polish Jews, put them on trains toward Poland.
Why couldn't you go to university?
Because I was a Jew.
The Effect on Us podcast. Here's Eliane Goldstein.
The Effect on Us is a podcast for people of all ages to learn about controversial subjects and the ties it has to people nowadays. In this season, the focus of the series is the Holocaust. You'll be able to hear some of the best survival stories I've ever heard from people that went through the Second World War and learn more about the effect the Holocaust had on people from Generation 1 to Generation 3.
Did you know that between 1.1 and 1.5 million people died at Auschwitz, 90% of them being Jews? In this episode, I'm talking to Eva Perlman, who tells me about what she refers to as a series of miracles that helped her and her family survive the war. What is your name?
Eva Perlman.
How old are you?
I am 89 and a half. I'm going to be 90 in May.
Where and when were you born?
I was born in Germany, Berlin, May 18, 1932, 8 months before Hitler came to power. My father was a patent attorney. He was working with an elderly man who groomed him to take over. But of course, as soon as Hitler started working against the Jews could no longer work. And my father was lucky enough to have a partner in Paris with whom he had worked for several years, who esteemed him a lot and who wrote to my father saying, if it becomes difficult for you in Germany, come over here to Paris, you will work with us right away. So my father had the opportunity and he had the wisdom to take it. So by August of 1933, my father was already in Paris. My mother at the time was a medical student at the Berlin University, and she wanted to finish. This was a dream of her life. And she stayed behind with me. My grandparents were taking care of me while she was at the university. And by October, she received a letter from the president of the university that she was from now on excluded from further studies at the university because of her Marxist activities. My mother was no Marxist. She was not interested in politics. She only had joined the Socio-Democratics club of students on campus so that she had access for free to the library, because she didn't have enough money to buy all the books. So she wanted to study at the library for free. So by October, she received that letter And she and I went to Paris to join my father. My maternal grandparents lived in a small village where my mother was born. And my grandfather was a jeweler and a silversmith. And he and my grandmother moved to Berlin because there was no more work. They didn't have any sales in their little village. Nobody wanted to go to the Jew anymore to buy anything, except maybe a few wedding rings that young men were buying just to give to their sweethearts just before they would be enlisted in the war, because the war was looming. So they were in Berlin for another while. And my two sets of grandparents at that time in 1933, when we left for France, were in Berlin. And I'll get back to them later. We lived near Paris in a large apartment building, which was inhabited by many German Jews who were refugees like we were. And we lived there for a while. My mother had another child, a brother for me, when I was 3 years old. And then my parents applied for citizenship in France. And I have all kinds of funny stories. By the way, I have a book. I wrote the book of my life here, Eva's Uncommon Life, Guided by Miracles. My life is just full of miracles. People will say they are coincidences. I believe they were miracles, especially when they saved our lives at the last minute. So we then moved into a villa in the other outskirts of Paris because the family was getting bigger. And I don't remember much about my childhood, except that it was difficult for my parents. We lived in a very difficult time between 33 and 39. And then my parents expected a third child, and all their friends were saying, "Are you crazy to bring another child into the world with the war looming and all that?" And my parents said, "Look, we have two children, so we'll have to be very careful with three. I mean, we have to be careful with two anyway." So, all right. So in the meantime, while my mother was expecting her third child, her parents from Berlin, my father sent them tickets to get on a boat from Palestine for China, for Shanghai. And those tickets enabled them to get out of Germany. But before they got out, they sent a letter to my mother saying, we have two trunks full of old stuff that we cannot take with us. We will send them to you. And when you get them, please keep them. And we will get them back if we ever get to see each other again. So when my mother was 18, 8.5 months pregnant with a big baby, she was really huge. She was called to the central railway station in Paris to get those two trunks through customs. And the customs official was very disagreeable. And he said, "Oh, you foreigners," he could hear that she had an accent in her French. "All you foreigners, why don't you go home where you belong? We don't need you here. We don't want you here." And open those trunks. And my mother got so furious and she got so red in the face. And she said to him, "Well, if your parents were in danger of their lives, wouldn't you want them to be, you know, go to a foreign country to save themselves, et cetera, et cetera?" She got so red and excited that he was afraid she would have the baby right there on the spot. So he finally said, "Okay, just take your junk and F off." So when my mother came home with those trunks with a taxi, sure enough, they were old clothes on the top, but the trunks were full of silver and jewelry and candlesticks and things, all the things that my grandfather bought from other Jews who wanted to leave Germany in a hurry and who wanted the money for those things instead of taking the actual ornaments and whatever. So had my mother known what was in the trunks, she would not have been able to be so genuinely angry. So that was just the first miracle. We got all that silver, and we still have my grandmother's jewelry and our candlesticks and so forth. So she had the baby, another brother for me, in April of 1939. And my mother was very worried, even in her hospital bed. She thought, where are my parents? They were supposed to be on a ship in March to Shanghai. We haven't heard from them. My God, where are they? Are they still in Germany? What? She was really deathly afraid for them. What happened was, and we knew later, that they arrived in Marseille, thanks to those tickets for Shanghai. And in Marseille, instead of going on to Shanghai, they boarded an illegal ship to Palestine, like the Exodus, but a small ship. And when I can show you my PowerPoint, which I'm not showing you now, I can show you pictures, all kinds of things that may be of interest to you if we do a Zoom by ourselves, if you are interested. So my grandparents were in Palestine after a very difficult trip on that illegal ship. And my other set of grandparents, my father's parents, came to join us out of Germany near Paris in August of 39, so just before the war started. And I don't know how they managed to get out of Germany at that late date, but it was August of 39. And my grandfather brought me some fairy tales from Hans Christian Andersen and the Grimm fairy tales. I don't know if you heard of them. And I've become a great aficionado of fairy tales. And that made me a very sentimental and romantic young lady. In German script, which I taught myself to read because I spoke German only until I was five and went to nursery school and to kindergarten. But I taught myself to read those tales. In 1940, things became dangerous in France. The Germans were starting to invade France from the north. And my father's boss, Monsieur Plassereau, whom we owe a great deal of gratitude, said to my father, I want you to go more south, take with you some of our archives that we have in the office, which we don't want to fall into German hands. And this gave my father a chance to leave Paris. He looked more Jewish than the rest of us. And so he took me and my first brother, who was 3 years younger, and we went about 100 miles south of Paris. My father rented a little castle. I was eight, he was five, my brother. My mother and my grandparents and the baby stayed in Paris, near Paris. I was taken with acute appendicitis suddenly and had to be operated on within an hour or two, or else I could have died. And we were lucky that there was a hospital nearby where there was a good surgeon, because he told my father that he operated at the last minute. It could have burst and I would have died infection, because we didn't have antibiotics yet in 1940 or 41. Also, there were lots of bombings while we were in that castle, and we always went into the basement. But one day when we came back out of the basement, we found that a huge piece of bomb had come through the glass roof of the veranda under which my father had his office chair and desk, and it went straight through the chair. So had he stayed at his desk during the bombing, he would have been killed. Again, the hand of God everywhere in my life. I thank God and I count my blessings every day. Eventually, my grandfather in Paris died, and my mother couldn't even let my father know that his father had died. She was alone there to do the funeral, and we didn't know about it. Then a year later, it was time to leave where we were to go further south. And France was at that time divided into two parts, the northern part through the middle, was occupied by the Nazis, and the bottom half was still the free zone. So we went to Lyon. Lyon was still in the free zone. If you look at the map of France, you will see our trek. So my father took the two of us, and we went to Lyon. And he opened another office there, and he rented an apartment again in the suburbs of Lyon. Then my mother tried to come with my grandmother and the baby to join us in Lyon. And she arrived at the demarcation line between the two zones. And again, one of the guys there, a Frenchman, was very unpleasant. And he said, well, you and the baby, you can go. The old woman stays behind. And my mother made a huge fuss. She said, I'm not going to leave her behind. You forced me to stay here with the baby and her. And if anything happens to us, it will be on your conscience. And so she made such a fuss again. She was a very strong woman. She made such a fuss that he finally had enough. And he said, okay, just go. So we were all in Lyon. And that was 1941. So there we stayed in that apartment in Lyon for about a year. And during that time, the Germans were coming closer and closer. And my mother said to my father, you know, we have to find a place to put the children so that nothing will happen to them. And at that time in France, and especially south of Lyon, southwest of Lyon, in a mountainous region of low mountains, like 3,000, the villages were at 3,000 feet altitude, which is not very high, and the mountains were not very high. And though all these mountains were speckled with homes for children that were like summer camps or even camps during the year for schooling, but it was like a camp, but in a regular big home and in dormitories and so forth. And those homes were used by French people until then to put their children in there for 2 weeks or a month or 2 months during the summer, and then they could go on vacation by themselves. So my mother went to that area, and she went from one to the other, to the third, to the fourth. They were all full. They could not take three children. And finally, the last one, my mother was very desperate to find a place to put the three of us. She found a place in Clairefontaine where the lady, Madame Montonnex, was willing to take the three children. And she knew we were Jewish children, and she knew she was risking her life, but she took us anyway. And actually, Monsieur and Madame Montonnex are inscribed at Yad Vashem as righteous Gentiles. We owe our lives to several righteous Gentiles. Some of them were not inscribed in Yad Vashem because they didn't risk their lives enough, I was told. But still, in my view, they were all righteous, very righteous Gentiles. So the three of us were there for 9 or 10 months until 1943 sometime. And my mother came to visit. And the last time she came to visit for the weekend, she got a telegram from my father, stay up there, I'm coming. My father had decided it was time for him to go into hiding. And so he came, and he rented the upstairs of a yellow house. We called it the yellow house all our lives. And it's still yellow, by the way. He rented the upstairs of a house. Our landlord and landlady lived downstairs. And they knew we were Jewish, and they rented to us. And they did not, of course, they risked their lives. But my father paid them, so we were not being sheltered for free like many non-Jews did help Jews. But we still owe them our lives. So my mother had to set up shop suddenly. She only came for the weekend with a little package. And there she was faced with a kitchen with not much in it. So she decided she has to go to Lyon for the day to our apartment to pick up whatever she needed from the kitchen. and her, some clothes for herself. And it was dangerous to go to Lyon already because the Nazis were all over. But she said, I have to, I'll be careful. She went to our apartment. She picked up what she needed and she was having tea with our landlady downstairs. Wonderful people, all these landlord and landladies where we lived. Everybody helped us. Nobody betrayed us. In France in those days, there were two kinds of French people. The good ones who helped the Jews and the bad ones who betrayed them. And then the Nazis would come at 4 a.m. to pick them out of their beds and take them to Auschwitz or wherever. So they were having tea and suddenly my mother says, oh my God, I had missed my train. She had forgotten the time. And she ran down the hill to the tramway that she had to take. And the tramway left every 20 minutes. And it was just about to leave. Thank God she didn't have to wait. So she jumped in the train, in the tramway with her big load. And the tramway went along the Rhône River, passing lots of bridges. And at a particular bridge, she had to get off, run across the bridge, and the station, the railway station, was on the other side of the bridge. So she barely made it. I mean, when she arrived on the platform, the guy had whistled already. The train was leaving. She jumped in it almost when it was starting to move. And then she went to the window. She looked out the window of her compartment while she was still trying to catch her breath and taking off her hat. And looking out of the window, she saw that the bridge that she had just run across 3 or 4 minutes before was cordoned off at both ends by the Nazis and they were asking for papers. So my mother with with her identity card, although it was a French citizenship card, it had still her actual birthplace in Germany and her Gutmann last name, Gutmann. Goodman, and with that big burden with her, she would have been very suspicious as being somebody from the resistance, and she would have been embarked by the Nazis. So a matter of just a few minutes after my mother ran over that bridge. I mean, you know, I believe in God and in providential help. So we started living in Autran. I went to school for a year in a boys' school that happened to be there, and they took a few girls because of the circumstances. Autran was a charming little village of farmers, which had, in ordinary times, in peaceful times, it had 1,000 inhabitants. And at that time, there were 2,000 people living there. So that means half the population was hiding for some reason. So my father went on his bicycle 3 times a week to all the farmers, getting an egg or two here, a cup of milk there, straight from the cow, not pasteurized. And he exchanged his alcohol tickets and his tobacco tickets for food. And he, of course, paid as well. And Monsieur Placereau from Paris made it possible for my father to work part-time, although he was in that little village in Autran, in hiding. So once a week, my father would take the bus down to Grenoble, where a secretary from Lyon would come to meet him near the station. She would bring him new files to work on, and he would give her the files that he had worked on the past week. And that is how he was able to continue working, doing all things by hand. He didn't even have a typewriter in those days, not to speak of no computers or and we didn't have telephones either up in that village. Anyway, he was paid part-time so that he could feed the family. He had found a cave in the mountains where he hid some hard-boiled eggs and some drinking water and some money in case we all had to leave the house if the Germans were coming up. We always had alerts. The Germans are coming up. The Germans are coming up down from Autran in the plain. into the mountains. And we had a whole network of people coming from the post offices. When the first post office down near Grenoble saw that the Germans were trying to take one of the mountain roads to come into the mountains, because they figured many people were hiding in the mountains, the first post office would call the second one called the third one, the third, the fourth, etc. From each post office, two people would run, one to the baker, one to the hotel. From the bakery and the hotel, two people would run to warn two more people, and so forth, until within 5 minutes, everybody knew the Germans are coming up. And we had many false alerts because the roads were very gravelly and very narrow and very windy, and the Germans had trouble with their heavy equipment to negotiate those roads. So we had many false alerts. And we lived there. My mother wanted some new identity cards. In those days, they didn't drive cars yet. So they had identity cards for adults only, not children. And my mother went to the city hall. And she said, I would like some new cards for my husband and myself. And she was told by the clerk, we can only change them if they become illegible. So guess what? Unfortunately, those cards fell into the wash when my mother came home. And the next morning, they had dried, but they were illegible. So she went back to the city hall, and sure enough, he gave her cards with French last names and born somewhere in France, and dated the date of the old cards. So they looked really very genuine and perfect. And then the Americans came to Normandy, and we were all so happy, I remember. And we thought, okay, soon the war will be over. They will help us to beat the Germans. And then on Bastille Day, 1944, we went on a picnic to the top of a mountain at the end of the valley, and we hear planes. And my father says, oh, I hope these are American planes. And we watched them arrive and pass over us while we were eating. And then we watched them as they bombed our valley. So obviously they were not American planes. They were Nazi planes. And we ran down the hill, and my father decided, if I am to die, I will die with a weapon in my hand. And he and two friends of his, a father and son-in-law, enlisted the next morning in the underground French forces that were located actually not far from us in that same massif area of mountains, because they were difficult to take. So the men left the women and children to fend for themselves. And then the Germans really came. And the miracle again is that the three men, who were all looking very much more Jewish than their wives and children, had left for the underground forces. Again, just a miracle. The Nazis waited until our men left to come up. And they burned a farm here and a farm there. And the next day, our landlord calls us he calls my mother. Madame, can you please come and help me? There were two Nazis downstairs in the entrance at the door. And they didn't know any French. Our landlord didn't know any German. So our landlord called my mother to be the interpreter. And I don't know how my mother felt. I mean, she was so strong coming down the stairs, facing two Nazis, leaving three kids upstairs. And she did the interpretation. What they wanted was a bedroom in the house. They would eat their meals with our landlord downstairs, and they wanted a bedroom to sleep. And our landlord said, well, give them your bedroom since your husband is gone. My mother was speaking a horrible German with French accent, just lining words together without making correct grammatical sentences. And those two Nazis never had an inkling that she spoke German as well as they did. So they stayed for 2 weeks in our bedroom upstairs next to the three Jewish children, Can you imagine this? And my mother actually was talking. The orderly came to our kitchen to bake a chocolate cake for his boss, the colonel. And my mother was hoping, by being nice and talking to him in her horrible German, that maybe he would give the three children some crumbs of the cake, but he didn't give anything. Anyway, after 2 weeks, they left finally, and they didn't have time to burn the house down, which is what they usually did. When the Germans stayed somewhere, upon leaving, they would burn the place down and kill the inhabitants. But fortunately, they didn't have time. They were told to leave in a hurry. That was August 1944. No, July, at the end of July 1944. And they knew that maybe they wouldn't win the war, and they were scared, and they got the order to retreat immediately. So then they left, and my mother got a letter from a little piece of paper from the priest from the church up on the hill. That apparently came from my father, but it was a month old. What had happened was the resistance had been dissolved. They were told to save their souls. They were not enough, sufficient numbers to withstand the Germans. And my father and his friends had to make a big detour because our area was still full of Nazis. And they wanted to come to Autran as quickly as possible, so that, because the note said, we are okay, but we need civilian clothing and money. Can one of the ladies please come to meet us? And that little note came from one, it went from one priest to the next priest, to the next priest, to the next church, to the next church, until it got to our church in Autran. And the priest came to see my mother when she was out shopping, and she found the note on her kitchen table when she came home. And she immediately took the three of us back to Clairefontaine, to that home for children. She rented two bicycles, one for herself and one for the daughter of the other lady, whose husband was with my father in the resistance. And they took off with stuff on their bicycles. They went up to the pass in the mountains. They had their lunch. And then as they were starting the descent, my mother found out she had no brakes on her bicycle. The brakes didn't work. So she had a few seconds of huge anxiety. What is going to happen now? Am I going to go against the rock on one side or fall in the abyss on the other side? And fortunately, again, a providential accident kept them from going further. They were not badly injured, but enough that their trip was over. If they had not, and my father was at that time trying to get to Autran to keep my mother from getting that note, and he knew that she would immediately take off on her bicycle. And the place that she was going to go to was still completely occupied by Nazis. The Nazis had completely leveled several of the little villages around Grenoble. I mean, the whole place had been, they killed in some villages, they killed everybody from the newborns to the centenarians. They killed everybody. And if my mother and her young friend had not had that accident, they would have disappeared. They would have gone straight into German lines. Go figure, an accident that was godsend. And I got the message from Madame Montonex, your parents are okay, they'll be here in 2 or 3 days to pick you up. So then we lived in Autran another 2 or 3 months, and Lyon started to become liberated, and we went back to Lyon in the fall, in November or October or November of 1944. And eventually we went back to Paris. But a lot of other miracles on the way, for which there's not much time. And also it's difficult when you don't see what I'm talking about. But I thank God every day for his blessings and for having saved us. And I asked myself all my life, why were we obviously protected somehow? And I got my answer in my 80s, going on the March of the Living. And I've gone again, that fell into my lap in 2011 by chance. I did not look for it. I didn't know about it. And it just happened to become known to me. And I talked to the lady who organized it at the time, and she invited me to join them. So I've gone from 2011 to 2019 to Poland every year, and then to Israel. And I love being with the students. And they love being with me because I've kept a fairly young spirit.
What did you do during the day when you were, like, were you going to school during the day?
In that village?
Yeah.
Well, I was 10, 11 years old. I played with the young daughter of our landlord and landlady. They had two daughters, one who was my age and one who was already 20 years old. And I guess we just played. I mean, I went to school for a year for a few months, and I had homework to do. But I also played outside. We didn't have computers or cell phones or anything like that. I remember playing hopscotch with her. And I went in 2000. My granddaughter, who lives in Jerusalem, she made Aliyah and lives in Jerusalem with her husband and two children. She found the son of Monsieur and Madame Montonex from Clairefontaine. I had a true romance going at the age of 10 with her son, who was 11, Jean. And we didn't even hold hands, but we had a very special affection for each other. And we never spoke again for 70 years. And my granddaughter found him through Facebook. And so in 2012, my daughter, my granddaughter, and I went to southern France after the March of the Living to see Jean and his wife. He was already in his mid-80s. He was dying of lung cancer, and I'm so glad that we went. We hadn't seen each other for 70 years, and he gave me a big hug, and he was so happy to see me. It was really touching. And we were just kids, 10 and 11 at the time, you know. And he died less than a year later. So he gave me the name of the younger of the two girls of the landlord and landlady who still lived in the yellow house. So we went to see them as well. And I have a picture of me with the two ladies. I have a picture of them like they were at the time during the war. And now 70 years later, when we got together, it was very interesting. I asked them, weren't you afraid when the Nazis were in our house for 2 weeks? And one of them said, no, we already had Nazis in the house, so nobody would bother us. I am so grateful for the life I've led.
Where did you guys go after the war? You said that you went to Paris, but like, did you?
Yeah, we went back to Paris, and I continued my high school education. By the time I graduated, I was very, very immature for my age. I rebelled against my mother, who was busy with Hadassah. You know of Hadassah? It's called VISO in France. Women's International Zionist Organization. And she volunteered a lot of her time for Israel. And I resented that. She was never home. So my parents decided to send me to Israel to live for a year from at 18. I did not know what I wanted to study. And I had a huge inferiority complex growing up in France, which was a very anti-Semitic country and still is. And having a slight German accent in my French, so people were asking me if I were from Alsace or from Belgium or from somewhere else than Paris. And I felt, and being born in Germany when we just came out of the war against the Nazis, so my parents sent me to Israel for a year. I was not happy there because I lived with old friends of theirs from Germany. The man was a very nice man, very gentleman, a pharmacist, very nice guy. But his wife was a witch, and she made my life miserable. And so I went to cry on my aunt's sister's shoulder every week, at least twice. I went to school just learning home economics because I didn't know Hebrew. So I couldn't go to take any classes of any sort except learning to wash the floors and maybe make apple pie with zucchini. When you slice the zucchinis and you marinate them overnight in sweetened lemon juice, you could swear in the morning that they taste like apple. So since we didn't have apples, that was 1950 to 1951, and the Palestine became Israel only 2 years before. So we didn't have any apples, but we had zucchini. So we made apple pies with zucchini. And I met a friend of my sister, my aunt's sister, who 6 years later met my future husband. And she sent him to me to Paris on his way back to the States. And it was love at first sight like you wouldn't believe. And if you read my book, I mean, everything is in my book, all the details. I did not want to meet him. He was late in calling me, and I did not want to meet an American. I wanted to go make Aliyah where I could live without feeling embarrassed about being Jewish or born in Germany. And I opened the door. I was very angry when I opened the door, and we just looked at each other, and that was it. Within 45 minutes, each of us thought of possible marriage because we found out we both wanted to live in Israel, and the attraction was just phenomenally strong. And so after we got married, I was 24, he was 23. We went to Oxford, England, where he started graduate work in social anthropology. He wanted to become a social anthropologist to work in Israel with all the immigrants who came from different cultures to help them integrate into the Israeli culture. That was his dream. So after 2 years in Oxford, he had to go do research as an anthropologist in a primitive society. And we went to Uganda. We spent 3 years in Uganda. When we went to Uganda, we had one child. And in Uganda, I had two children, thanks to a medicine man whom I was treated by in the bush. And then another year in Oxford to get the PhD. And then he was offered two jobs, one in Jerusalem and one in Berkeley. And his mentor in England said, "My dear Mel, if I were you, I would take Berkeley. That comes once in a lifetime. You can always go to Jerusalem later." We went to Berkeley. We had three children. And going to Israel necessitates a lot of money. So we thought, okay, we'll go to Berkeley. In the 60s, it was 1963, and the 60s in Berkeley were kind of tumultuous. And by 1970, we went to Canada, where my son still lives in Canada, in Toronto. And my husband died in 1988. He was 55. He died of leukemia. And I came here in 1989 to be near my eldest daughter, who had a Jewish life. She married a Jew. My second daughter and my son intermarried at that time. My second daughter came in 2001 to live here from Canada with her family. And my son is still in Toronto, and he is remarried to a modern Orthodox woman, and he became more modern Orthodox. And that's my life. And I am now living at the Los Angeles Jewish Home for the Aging because I ran out of money, not because I can't cook anymore or do my shopping, but because I ran out of money. So I live here with my Social Security. And I'm very grateful to meet you, Eliane.
Thank you so much for speaking with me today.
You're welcome.
Isn't it amazing how the timing was always just right in her stories? I mean, it blows my mind. Join me next time when I talk to Paul Schwarzbart, who survived the war in a Catholic school where only two people knew he was Jewish. If you like this episode, please like and subscribe and tell your friends. This is Eliane Goldstein. Tune in next time to The Effect on Us. And remember, history will not repeat itself. Bye.
That was an interview with Eva Perlman, and the interview was by Eliane Goldstein from her podcast, The Effect on Us. Thanks to Eliane so much for her permission to broadcast the podcast episode. If you'd like to listen to more episodes of The Effect on Us, you can find them through The Effect on Us Facebook page, and you can also listen on Buzzsprout and all podcast apps. I'll link to that on the In the Motherhood CKUT Facebook page as well. If you'd like to know more, if you'd like to ask me any questions, or if you have ideas for future In the Motherhood shows, you can email me, Robin, at inthemotherhood@ckut.ca, and you can find us on Facebook, as I said, at inthemotherhood-ckut. Thanks so much for listening to In the Motherhood today here on CKUT 90.3 FM. Good night.
anything worth fighting for doesn't come for free. We believe in time that you will see how a war might save us, how a war might save us.
Thank you. Good evening and welcome to Amandla here on CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal. Amandla is 1 hour of African current affairs brought to you today by Doug and myself, Gwen, but principally really Doug. So Doug, what's lined up?
Well, exciting news from the Guardian, a special report on Chagos Islands. Chagos Islands, those little remote islands in the center of the Indian Ocean that are supposed to belong to Mauritius, but were taken over by Britain and sold to the United States. And the people who inhabited those islands were shipped out wholesale in 1968. Family, lock, stock, and barrel, dogs were killed. It was very reminiscent of colonial Northern Canada. Mm-hmm. And the people have done years and years of struggle and are now going home. They instead of just talking about it and going for heritage visits that the British allow them or the Americans allow them, they took a trip with their lawyer up to the home island of several of them, and they declared themselves home on their land. So that's coming from The Guardian, and I will also after that talk to people about